You're listening to a podcast from 702.
702. Family Matters.
22 minutes after 11, and we have our regular feature, Family Matters. I'm really excited to be joined by Jeannie Cavey, who's a clinical psychologist. Jeannie, thanks so much for joining us in the studio.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here always. It's very nice to meet you.
Yep. Likewise. And we have a really fascinating conversation ahead of us on trauma. Mm. Maybe let's just start, Jeannie, with thinking through what trauma is.
Okay, so the understanding of trauma has really changed over the sort of last 10 to 15 years. Hmm. In the latest diagnostic manual, which is very controversial amongst healthcare providers, they're still defining trauma as an event that has a serious threat to physical well-being or even death or sexual assault. Hmm. But what we're understanding really now about trauma is that it doesn't have to involve actual death, actual physical threat, that it can be caused by a variety of different life events that the brain, not the mind, that the brain deems a threat to survival. Hmm. And when I say the difference between the brain and the mind, what we're understanding now about trauma is that it's very much a brain event and not a mind event.
Okay.
Not how we feel about the event, but how our body reacts to the event. In a book called The Body Keeps the Score, Bessel van der Kolk, one of the pioneering works understanding trauma, talks about how trauma is actually the body's response to what it perceives to be a threat. Hmm. And that all happens in a very special almond-shaped structure in the middle of the brain called the amygdala. And the amygdala is almost like your house alarm. So you've got beams all around your house that are going to sense any kind of danger. And the amygdala lives in the middle parts of your brain and actually what we call the reptilian formation, which is a part of our brain that we share with reptiles, and they don't have any other part of their brain. We've got the reptilian formation, and that part has no thoughts, no logic, no reason. It's purely survival-driven conditioning stimulus response. Then around that, we've got the limbic system, which is the mammalian brain, which share with other mammals. That's emotion. Right. And then we've got our neocortex around that, the outer layer of the brain. And that's the most recent evolutionary development. And that's where we have thought, logic, reason, personality, drives, motivation, and even speech.
I see.
So what happens is, okay, your body's got these sensors all around it that are sensing danger. And if there is something that triggers one of these sensors within fractions of a split second, your amygdala shuts everything down to see, okay, is this a real threat, and sends out the house alarm. Hmm. If it is a real threat, the amygdala, within fractions of a split second, will decide what to do about it. First of all, it's going to arrest. So it's going to stop what it's doing and look what's going on. If somebody walks past the window here, we're busy working now, we won't say, you know, Cesar, I think there's somebody standing there. I'm just going to turn and have a look. Mm. My head will automatically orient to that.
Right.
And if it's just somebody watching what we're doing, I'll just carry on what I'm doing. But if it's somebody with a gun, my brain will decide immediately, okay, can I run away, flight? Can I do that? If I can't do that, can I stand my ground and fight? If I can't do that, can I freeze? Will it just go past me if I freeze? And if none of those is going to work, the amygdala goes into fold response, which is collapse into helplessness.
Hmm.
Okay. Now, this can happen with any kind of perceived threat to the amygdala, because remember, it doesn't have thoughts, it doesn't have logic, it doesn't have reason. So it doesn't have to be somebody with a gun. It can be an ugly fight with a partner. It can be parental neglect. It can be losing a job. It can be getting stressed out in traffic.
Mm.
But the activation of the amygdala itself, the house alarm going off itself, is not the trauma. The trauma is when the house alarm doesn't get rebooted.
Okay.
So let's say you've got your PIN code, whatever it is, you go and you punch that PIN code and you calm down. Okay, that's one thing. But now your service provider, your armed response provider, they're going to phone you, right? And they're going to say, is everything okay there?
Sure.
Now, if you don't know that password and your conscious brain doesn't know that password, if you don't know that password, they're still going to send guys to come and check. And your body's going to remain alert. Your body's going to remain in that survival response. And that is what we call trauma.
Wow. Okay. Can I just stop you there?
Because of course, I think it's very technical.
No, it's fascinating. And I think, you know, these traumas confront us in our lives in so many different ways. But what I think you're bringing across here is the actual physical effects of trauma. This is not just, you know, my mind and I, you know, I think and I have memories, but it's about the entire physical process that engulfs your body when you're faced with a traumatic situation.
100%. So Freud himself, he was the first one to say, when he saw somebody with trauma, with what we would call PTSD now, he said, oh, I think this man is suffering from memories. And 20, 30 years ago, people thought that trauma was a disruption of memory, that we thought that things that happened in the past were happening now. But it's true in a sense that the amygdala does think that the threat is current, the threat is ongoing. You haven't given it that secret password to reboot it.
Right.
But it's not in the cortex. It's not in the memory parts of the brain. It's in the subcortex, in the reptilian parts of the brain that is purely survival driven. Mm. And it's not to do with how brave you are or how tough you are or how at peace you are in your conscious mind about what happened or the fact that you did survive, the fact that you didn't actually maybe get physically injured. It's got very much to do with what your amygdala perceived to be a threat. Mm. And if you don't reboot that amygdala, if you don't understand how the brain works to reboot it, to give it that secret password, then you can have PTSD symptoms and trauma symptoms going forward.
And before we get on to the kind of methods we can use to start that rebooting process, in what other ways does trauma affect us? What's the true effect of trauma?
Okay, so to describe that, I'll talk to you about this video that we use to describe trauma and demonstrate what trauma is and also how to treat trauma.
Cool.
And it's a real video. It's an impala that's been caught by a leopard. And those of us working with trauma will be familiar with this video. So it's a beautiful video that my colleague Chris Aitzinger shared with us at a trauma talk once. That this impala is captured by this leopard, but this leopard has got his mouth around the impala's mouth and he's busy suffocating the impala. And the impala's eyes completely glassy, its ears are not moving, it's not breathing. And this impala looks dead. And the amygdala of that impala is currently in fold response, as if collapsed into helplessness. Some baboons come along and they chase the impala of the leopard away. Mm. And baboons are like really serious like that. The leopard is even afraid of them. And this impala lies there. It looks completely dead. It just flops. And then after a while, as they continue to film, you start to see that this impala starts diaphragmatic breathing. There's a nerve that goes from the diaphragm into the survival center, into the amygdala, called the polyvagal nerve. And here with this diaphragmatic breathing, the impala is sending messages to the amygdala that we're not dead and we need to reboot so that we can carry on living. Hmm. And then the impala sort of comes up into a half-seated position and looks like he's having a seizure. But actually what's happening is he's acting out his flight response. If you slow it down, you can see he's acting out his flight response in this sort of different altered states of consciousness. He then gets up, he does this big diaphragmatic breath, shakes it out, and moves on. Okay, so that's how he rebooted his amygdala to say, okay, I did ensure my own survival. I gave the armed response guys the secret password. Now, your question is, what would happen if he didn't do that?
Let's stop there because we're going to go to the headlines. So we're going to take a quick break for the headlines with Thabo Baloyi, and when we get back, we go on to how we reboot this amygdala so that we can deal better with the traumas in our lives.
702
Family Matters.
Just gone 11:30. I'm Sizwe Mpofu-Walsh, standing in for Eusebius Mkhize over the next 3 weeks, and we are talking family matters. We're with Jeannie Cavey, who's a clinical psychologist, and we're discussing trauma, what it does to the body, and how we can overcome it, what steps we should take. And Jeannie, before we went to the headlines, you were just sharing the analogy of what trauma can do to a body through a story about something in the natural world. And you were about to reflect on what that means for us here.
Yes. Thanks, Izzy. So animals in the wild still have retained this connection with their body and understand how to reboot. They still have the secret password.
Right.
But because of how we've developed socially, we often interrupt the completion of our fight or flight response.
Okay.
So I'll give you an example of what I mean by that right now. This client of mine was driving along after work, and a drunk pedestrian fell into the road, and this man was killed. My client did everything that he was supposed to do socially. Mm. He stopped the car, helped the guy, called an ambulance. Ambulance didn't come, took him to a hospital, gave his name at the desk, went to the police station, reported the case.
Sure.
And he sat with PTSD symptoms. And I asked him, at the time that you knew what was happening, what did you want to do? And he said, I wanted to run away. But because that would be socially inappropriate and could cause worse effects for him later, he interrupted that flight response.
Right.
So what would happen to the impala if it didn't complete its flight response is the same thing that happens to us. The impala starts to suffer with symptoms of trauma.
Hmm.
Can't eat, sleep disruption, flashbacks.
Hmm.
But the worst symptom of trauma is actually the disconnection that we have from one another. The neurophysiological systems that govern, this is according to Peter Levine, one of the major thinkers in trauma worldwide now.
Okay.
The same structures that govern trauma also govern our structures for connection, sense of well-being, and belonging.
Hmm.
And I read something very beautiful the other day that said trauma affects our relatedness because patterns of connection are replaced with patterns of protection. And that was Stephen Porges who said that.
So we start to become kind of
dissociated.
Distant.
Yeah, dissociated right. and disconnected. And as you and I were talking just a moment ago through the headlines, that it actually becomes a way of being in the world.
Hmm.
It's not just a reaction to that trauma. It's a way of being in the world.
Mm.
And the more traumas we have, the more sensitive our house alarm beams become. So that eventually it's not just a person walking through when we've set it. It could be a house fly. It could be anything that sets it off.
Mm.
And a person starts to live in this dissociated, disconnected way of not being able to connect because they're so busy protecting.
By the way, give us a call if you'd like to discuss this question about, you know, moving through your world, your life. Maybe you've experienced a trauma and you're overcoming that now that you'd like to reflect on here. Make sure you give us a call and we can, you know, discuss this in greater detail. 011-883-0702. We're keen to take your calls. And Jeannie, I think what's really interesting in what you're saying is that trauma can also have a cumulative effect.
Yes, definitely.
So one trauma can build onto a previously unresolved trauma, and this can begin to build if we don't start to deal with these traumas and reverse, or at least as you say, grapple with this physical process that's taking place in our brains.
100%. So we always say that neurons that fire together wire together. So the more a person is exposed to trauma, the more and more they start to live in this traumatized way of being. And it doesn't have to just be a physical threat. It can be interpersonal in any way. Because remember, the survival center was developed millions and millions of years ago where our world looked very different. We didn't have the same kind of social life that we have now. We didn't have the same kind of way of being. So anything that threatens survival, as the amygdala deems it, without logic, without reason, can cause that trauma reaction.
Just on that, within the family, what are the kinds of things that might spark that traumatic reaction?
So it can be anything from financial stress in the family, children becoming aware of family financial stress.
Mm.
It can be parents fighting a lot with one another.
Mm.
And parents think, oh, the children don't know because we do it behind closed doors. But our central nervous systems tune into one another in a process called neuroception. And children are aware of it. Things like, obviously, childhood sexual abuse is a major one.
Mm.
And obviously other traumas that happen to the family, armed robberies, things like that.
Sure.
But even parental neglect, parents criticizing or humiliating a child, all of those things can have that traumatic effect. And it's so important, like you say, it's not about thinking it through or working out the meaning of it. Primarily, it has to start with the bottom of the brain. In trauma therapy now, we talk about a bottom-up approach, where we work from the bottom of the brain, of first regulating the amygdala, first looking at rewiring how the amygdala is firing on a subcortical level, and then moving on to the emotion, and then moving on to the meaning of it.
Mm.
And there we're looking at the brain-based therapies. Can I go into those
brain-based
therapies?
Yeah, by all means. I'd be really interested to find out, you know, what the appropriate way of trying to deal with a trauma would be.
Okay, so obviously it's important to get assistance for trauma because we have become disconnected. We have forgotten that secret password that we need to give the armed response team.
Mm.
So it is important to do brain-based therapy. Talk therapy is a very important part of therapy, to have that relationship. And brain-based therapy doesn't replace talk therapy, but it goes beyond talk therapy. So you need that relationship and you need the talk therapy. But talk therapy alone cannot treat trauma. We have to look at brain-based therapies.
And what are those kinds of therapies?
Okay, so the ones that are very well-known at the moment and well-researched at the moment, their names are somatic experiencing. There's one called eye movement desensitization reintegration, EMDR, EMI, brain spotting hypnotherapy, and brain working recursive therapy.
Okay.
Now, all of these work in different ways to access on a subcortical level what's happening with the amygdala. For example, in brain spotting, what we do is we use the visual pathways.
Mm-hmm.
Same in EMDR, same in EMI. We use the visual pathways because our eyes are an extension of our brain. So where we look affects what neural pathways we tap into. If I say to you, what did you have for dinner last week, Tuesday night? And you have to try remember, what did you have? Try remember. You got to look away.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yes,
you
got to look away. What did I have?
Yeah.
So in those eye-based therapies, we use the visual pathways to find the neural pathway that knot of trauma is coded into. And we use the brain's own self-regulation by focusing on that spot of trauma, that knot of trauma, to regulate through it.
Interesting.
In brain working recursive therapy, what we do is we, on a more metaphorical level, we use a metaphor of a lived experience, giving the amygdala the experience of having worked through its fight or flight response through a series of visualizations. And that's how that amygdala then moves through. And in hypnotherapy, what we do is we use a particular pattern of brainwaves that's very therapeutic for the amygdala, and we can use any of the other techniques with that as well. And then the last one that I want to just mention, somatic experiencing, which is a beautifully effective form of trauma therapy, is where the person uses their body, because remember, like Bessel van der Kolk says, the body keeps the score. Person uses their body to work through that amygdala response in a similar way to what that Impala did,
miming out
the running away, somatic experiencing on a different level. That's how that works. But if you don't have access to psychotherapy, then it would be important to do work that functions with your brainwaves. So meditation and yoga are very good for regulating the pattern of brainwaves. But you have to understand that it is about connecting. So talk therapy is important for talking it through, but that won't treat the trauma. You have to work on a subcortical level to regulate the amygdala, to regulate the reptilian part of the brain, so that the person can start to relate again. And we first regulate, then we can relate, and then we can reason. So we start with the reptilian, then we work into the limbic system, and then we work into the cortex from the bottom up into the brain.
Excellent. Hope you're gaining some insights as you deal with all that life is throwing at you. We're here with Jeannie Cavey, who's a clinical psychologist, and we're talking about trauma. I see a number of your calls coming through. We are going to be taking a quick break, and we'll come back to your calls after the break.
702 Family Matters.
Welcome back to Family Matters. It's about to hit 11:45, and we're here with Jeannie Cavey as we're discussing trauma. I'm taking your calls as well, and I'm going to go to Catherine. Catherine, thanks for joining us. Catherine, is that you?
It's good. Insurance quote.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you now, Catherine. What's on your mind?
S3.
Catherine, there seems to be someone trying to call you, some kind of robot trying to call you. So we're going to go to another call, which is Irene. Irene, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, guys.
Hi.
I was a police officer for 25 years, so I saw a lot of horror, okay? But what I'm finding today is, to me, the whole of South Africa is in trauma, because we don't know what is going to happen to us every day, whether we're taking children to school or going to work, walking in the road. You know, we're having to look over our shoulders all the time. And then people say, yeah, but the sun is shining. You know, I'm sorry, but that's not enough. We're all in trauma. We all need, well, I am a counselor, but I find this fear is just getting worse and worse, and crime is getting worse, and crime is getting more vicious and more ugly. And I don't know. We've got to try and get to the core of that apple, because to wake up every day, that's what I'm trying to say, is we're all stressed. But we can't all go to counselors and be spoken to, and everything's going to be okay, don't worry. You know, just be aware of your surroundings. I'm sorry, it's not enough. We have to do something. We have to take back our own country, really.
I couldn't agree with you more, Irene. I think anybody that would know what's going on out there would be you, having worked as a police officer for 25 years.
Yeah.
And the more and more exposed we get, the less and less of the wonderful, important coping mechanism of denial we have. We all have an incredibly beautiful coping mechanism called denial. And people always say denial is a bad thing, but it's a very important coping mechanism, because without it, we wouldn't be able to function. So if I was completely aware of what could happen every time I get in my car, what could happen every time I eat, you know, that extra chocolate croissants, you know, I wouldn't be able to live my life. We'd be completely immobilized. And the more and more we get exposed to trauma, both firsthand and secondhand, and through the news and the media and what we see even on the side of the road, the more and more our beautiful function of denial gets compromised, and we start to live in an activated state all the time. And Irene is completely correct. And I think that obviously the best solution would be for us to get along better as human beings. But I think it's a global problem, and I don't know if it is getting worse or we're just getting more and more aware of it globally. There have been atrocities that we've performed against one another since the beginning of time, but we are more and more aware of it, like Irene says. And obviously the solution would be for there to be less traumatic events in society, but our survival is constantly under threat. And I think that the most important thing that we can do as a society is not to isolate ourselves or one another. when we become very anxious, our instinct tells us to isolate. But isolation actually causes more anxiety. So think about how we live here in Joburg. We're very anxious. So we live in complexes, behind electric fences. We drive with our windows up, and we become very isolated. And remember, like I said, that those systems that govern connection also govern trauma. So when we connect effectively, we can also deal with trauma effectively. But it's not connecting by telling somebody that the sun is shining and everything is going to be okay. It's connecting on a deep neurobiological level of empathy, of becoming aware of another person's frame of reference without judgment, without contaminating from your own frame of reference, and connecting with a person in that way. That can help our traumatized society to cope with the reality of what it is that we're facing on a day-to-day basis.
Well, thanks very much for that. And thanks for the call as well. We have a few calls coming in, so I'm going to go to those. We're going to try and go back to Catherine. Catherine, are you with us?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry for the insurance call.
No problem.
Good morning, Susie and Jenny.
Hi, Catherine.
From what I've heard, your previous listener asked a similar question. I just want to take it a little bit further in that you've touched on it, but you haven't elaborated on the consequences on your adrenals of trauma. And that my observation is similar to the previous caller in that our society is suffering from extensive dissociation, which may be as a result of trauma. But I would also take it further in that in my peer group between the ages of 30 and 50, I'm witnessing unprecedented adrenal fatigue.
Yeah, Catherine.
And which is that, would you argue that that's linked, the two are linked together?
You're 100%
and then I want to make
right.
another... And I want to make another observation to childhood psychology in that in terms of containment and holding, and my generation being mid-30s now, my parents were taught, no, you've got to let a baby at some point cry it out. But when a baby is crying, it's activating its adrenal systems. And if unleft, you're letting a very young adrenal system that's still in the development mode actually become defunct, because you're unable to then, there's no regulation because I'm in constant distress.
Okay.
And does that perhaps have a latent effect now in terms of how we process trauma and our adrenal systems that are actually defunct now? Because this was sort of a psychological precedent of the 70s, 80s, early 90s to let babies cry out.
Thanks.
Sure, what beautiful questions. And Catherine, obviously somebody that's very in tune and somebody that's obviously knowing what's going on out there. So two beautiful questions, and I'll tackle them both now. So yes, what happens is when our amygdala becomes activated, so that's like putting the foot on the accelerator to say, okay, we're going into survival drive now.
Right.
And the adrenals provide fuel for that. But evolutionarily speaking, we're not designed to live the way that we're living now. We're not actually designed to drive in the cars that we drive, because when they crash, what happens to us? We break ourselves. So what happens is that because we are overusing these adrenals, they're not actually keeping up with the demand, and they're going into burnout, they're going into adrenal fatigue. And we're seeing people with initially very high levels of cortisol, which is the byproduct of adrenaline when it gets metabolized, into almost no cortisol, because it's actually no adrenaline happening in the body.
Sure.
And I'm seeing a lot of clients that present with what we think is depression, that fold response. And when I refer them to an endocrinologist, who is the best person to treat adrenal fatigue, an endocrinologist is somebody that works with the hormone systems of your body, then actually when they come back from the endocrinologist, he says, no, they've got complete adrenal fatigue and complete adrenal burnout. And I think that one of the most traumatic environments that a person can find themselves in nowadays is working in corporate. Because the amount of clients that I'm seeing, your survival is not guaranteed. You can be retrenched at any minute. Somebody can take your job at any minute. You can't just be good at your job. You have to be excellent at your job. You can't just work 9 to 5. You have to work weekends as well. You have to work long hours. You have to perform. And the juice, the fuel that's called up for that perform is all coming from your poor adrenals that can't keep up. And a person can have anxiety, can have dissociation, can have depression. can have all sorts of symptoms that's actually due to adrenal fatigue, just like Catherine says. Hmm. And then to her second question, it's another beautiful question, one of my favorite topics. And I just want to make it very clear, it's not to mom shame anybody that's just trying their best out there. But yes, if you leave a baby to cry it out, research now shows that the cry it out method, the reason why the baby stops crying is they go into the fold response. Hmm. They go into collapse into helplessness. Hmm. And they're biologically programmed to stop crying so that they don't attract a predator. So babies do stop crying with the cry it out method because they're actually going into a survival response of collapse into helplessness. Mm. And Catherine is very right, but I think it goes back further to our grandparents and our great-grandparents who are all traumatized by World War One, World War Two, various right. border wars here in South Africa and Zimbabwe all around us.
Mm.
And
apartheid,
not to mention, oh yes, that thing.
Yeah.
You know, and we look at transgenerational trauma. We look at three generations of Holocaust survivors, how their children, all great-grandchildren, all have markers for PTSD.
Yeah.
A very interesting study was done on mothers who were in their last 3 months of gestation around ground zero, 9/11. They all saw the Twin Towers coming down and all their babies were born with genetic markers for PTSD.
Wow.
Because it's actually a survival response. It's actually our body trying to help us to survive. So yeah, very much that our parents were raised by people who were traumatized, became traumatized themselves, traumatized us, left us to cry, let us sleep on our stomachs. And yeah, we are living in a generation of people who are programmed towards trauma because of all of those generational traumas and apartheid and the society that we currently live in. And we each have to now take responsibility for the generation after us to relate more effectively, to teach their amygdalas how to regulate themselves. Mm. Because how we regulate ourselves is how our children regulate themselves. If you've ever thought about why, when we pick up a baby, do we naturally want to hold that baby to the left? Why do we do that? And everybody does it. Left-handed people do it. Right-handed people do it. And a lot of people think it's to do with the heartbeat, but the heart is actually very close to center, just off left of center, and the baby sits here in the crook of your arm. It's actually because our right-hand amygdala, most responsible for regulation, plays out on the left side of our face.
Hmm.
And we want the baby to look at the left side of our face so that they can learn to regulate through neuroception and mirroring of those regulatory neurons how to regulate themselves, because a well-regulated child is a delight. A well-regulated child sleeps easily, doesn't cry too much, doesn't throw a tantrum, listens to mommy and daddy. So how we can help our society, like Irene was asking and how Catherine is actually beautifully pointing out, is first of all to look after ourselves extremely well and to make sure that we are regulated and attend appropriately to our children's biological needs so that they can become regulated also.
Absolutely. A lot of calls coming in. Not sure if we're going to be able to get to all of them, but I'm going to go to Simon. Thanks for calling in. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I kind of picked this up a bit late in the show, but my experience is I've spent 20 years as an advanced life support paramedic in and around not only Johannesburg, but Africa.
Mm.
And from my experience, and certainly from a lot of the articles that I've read recently, part of the trauma that we seem to be seeing is it is crime related, and we treat trauma and crime, or we treat crime as a as something that the police are supposed to deal with, instead of as a medical problem or a healthcare problem.
Mm.
There's interesting studies that have been done overseas, and in fact, even by the World Health World Economic Forum, in terms of places like Glasgow, which in 2005 was the most dangerous city in Europe. They've managed to turn that around with different policing strategies. So I think that there's a much, or that we need to look at different approaches. I think what you've said to your previous caller was interesting. But I think that there's a much broader scope here that's being missed.
Okay. Thanks for that, Simon. I'm going to try and fit in one further question just so that we can get our final caller. Sizwe.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning, Sizwe. If you wouldn't mind keeping it relatively brief so that we can just get back to Jeannie to round off.
Yeah, I'll do that. It's just that I would like to find out a report by an intern psychologist on somebody who has a military background. What are the chances of that report being, you know, a misreport or maybe not a proper report compared to a report by a psychiatrist?
Okay.
I mean, can you compare it to, or maybe what would be if the report by an intern psychologist and a report done by a psychiatrist?
Okay, thanks very much for that, Sizwe. Jeannie, we'll come to you to round off.
So just to get back to Sizwe's question, I think there's not enough information available for me to answer that question appropriately, but if you'd like to maybe make contact with me afterwards, I just don't have enough information to respond because it's all contextual based.
Cool.
So I think just to round off with regards to trauma, I think the most important thing is to just be aware, yes, we are living in a traumatized society, and like Simon said, yes, it would be obviously most optimal to look at crime and to look at the way that we're traumatizing each other. But remember, traumatized people also traumatize people. Those people are also living with childhood abuse. Those people are also living with poverty. Those people are also desperate and also committing crimes out of trauma. So if we look at well-regulated society, we look at also less trauma. So it's very important to be patient with someone with trauma. Remember, they're not choosing to not get over the trauma. Their ability to connect and ask for help can also be affected. So be patient, proactive, and persistent in your support. And most importantly, where available, try to get some brain-based therapy, because talk therapy alone is not enough to help a person who's traumatized. And most importantly, to stay connected with one another and not isolate.
Jeannie, thanks so much. Where can people find you if they need to reach out to you?
They can find us at impacttherapy.co.za. I've got a wonderful team of psychologists. We're all trained in brain-based therapies. We're based in Four Ways, and if Four Ways is not within your area, we'd be happy to refer you and help you to find proper brain-based help as well. impacttherapy.co.za.
Thanks so much for joining us. That's Jeannie Cavey, clinical psychologist. We've been talking about trauma. And that brings to an end that conversation.